right. This morning we have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We'll proceed directly through both of those. Welcome to everybody that we have here from out of town. We appreciate you coming here today. Our first case is Ross versus Aiken, and then the second case is State of Texas versus Davidson. So we'll begin with Ross, and if the clerk will please announce counsel, who'll be arguing. All right, Mr. Fielding.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Morning.
This is an appeal from a granting of summary judgment and removal of office of a long-time county commissioner in Wise County. He was removed under a particular statute, often called the automatic removal statute. It's a statute that provides 87.031 that the conviction of a county officer by a petty jury for any felony or for a misdemeanor involving official misconduct operates as an immediate removal from office. The order in this case was granted under that statute. Now, he was clearly not convicted of a felony, so the only way he could be removed from office under that statute was if he committed a misdemeanor involving official misconduct. Now, what was the misdemeanor that he committed? He built a treehouse for his grandchildren, and he wanted to keep it a secret for him because it was a Christmas present. And he built that treehouse in the county barn where he worked. County property, you could argue, as the state did in this case, that he shouldn't have done that. But he wasn't thinking, I don't believe, as the record shows, about violating any rules or laws. He just wanted to get that built for his grandkids. He and his wife were going to build it together. He went down and bought the materials that he needed, and he started assembling it. And so he was convicted of an offense, the second offense I'll talk to you about in this case, and that's the offense of abuse of official capacity. This is Penal Code Section 39.02, and that statute says a public servant commits an offense if, with intent to obtain a benefit or with intent to harm or defraud another, he intentionally or knowingly misuses government property, services, personnel, or any other thing of value belonging to the government. Now, you'll notice in that, what I just read, nowhere is the term official misconduct used. He was not convicted of official misconduct. He pled guilty to this, by the way, and he was convicted of the offense of abuse of official capacity, a Class B misdemeanor. So, clearly, since he wasn't convicted of official misconduct, a misdemeanor involving official misconduct, the question becomes, was it appropriate to remove him from office under Section 87.031, which requires that if it's a misdemeanor, it has to have been for official misconduct. And that's the argument he made. He set forth facts in the summary judgment proceeding, explaining to the court what had happened. He didn't intend to violate any law. I know the other side has cited the court to some cases that say, well, his intent may or may not have been too important, but that's really not the law. If you read the statute, it says that he has to let me get it in front of me.
You're looking at Section 87.031 on immediate removal?
Yes.
And a misdemeanor involving official misconduct?
Yes. And official misconduct means intentional, unlawful behavior relating to official duties. That's what that means. It's longer than that, but that's the way it starts. There's case law.
Once he pled guilty and judicially admitted the elements that were listed in the charging instrument against him, how do you get around that he has admitted he acted intentionally or knowingly and committed an act that misused government property?
Nowhere in that indictment was official misconduct alleged.
I understand that. I understand it. We're on the same page there.
Yeah, okay.
But nevertheless, he judicially admitted he acted intentionally or knowingly, correct?
Right.
And he judicially admitted that he misused government property, correct?
He did.
How is that not a violation of official duties?
It's not official misconduct. There is a fact question.
I understand
question.
It's not the title. I get that.
I say we have raised a fact issue on whether or not what he did and what he pled to doing was, as a matter of law, official misconduct. I say there's a fact issue on that. That's what this case is really all about. And by the way, the case law, which I failed to cite, there's a case called Deanda versus State, 131 Southwest 3rd, 198, that said it relies on two Supreme Court cases back in the early 60s, Meyer and Reyna. And it quotes from Meyer saying, official misconduct must be willful, or in other words, with evil intent, or without reasonable grounds to believe the act lawful. And we don't have that in this case. Yeah?
Do those cases deal with the penal offense of official misconduct?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Are you drawing a distinction between official misconduct as it's defined in Local Government Code 870013 and the offense? Is there a separate penal offense?
I'm not aware. I think there a lot of the offenses say official misconduct, and they go back to that definition, to the definition 87.001. So I'm saying they had to show evil intent, and they didn't do it. Now, yeah, maybe he shouldn't have used that county barn. I don't know about if you grew up in the small counties like I did, you know people use the county barn for all kinds of things. They're down putting floats together. But in this case, he was doing it for his grandkids. When it was called to his attention that it might be wrong, he felt bad about it, as he testified in his affidavit. But he was not guilty of evil intent or of having reasonable grounds to believe that the act was unlawful.
Well, you go on to the issue regarding the trial court's failure to include a judgment of removal in the actual judgment.
Yes, there are cases that say if the judge doesn't do it in the criminal conviction, it can still be found later that he was immediately removed from office. That's what I think that their cases say, and I think we agree with those cases. But in this case, the judge did not do it when the conviction happened. The conviction order of the court has nothing to do with the removal from office. And he believed, as we have in the affidavit, he was going to get his job back. In fact, the materials that we submitted to you in the record suggested that he could continue to serve. So to come back later and say, well, yeah, okay, Judge, you failed to put it in the order, so let's go ahead and summary judgment it now. That would give me pause if I were you, because the judge didn't put it in the first time. This is a really good judge, and I think he would have if he had intended to remove him from office.
You said that there was evidence that he believed he was going to get his job back, but is there any evidence, because it seems to be hotly disputed, that the prosecutor gave him any reason to believe that?
Well,
they say there isn't.
I know, and he says there is, so it seems to me like there's a fact issue on that. This is a summary judgment case. I think it should be remanded for a trial. We can let Bob Gill come in and testify. We can let my client testify. Maybe Jerry Lofton, he was the one dealing with Gill on the case. A lot of my client's information would have come from Jerry, but the point is there is a fact issue there on that point. So Now,
I have a question, too, on the first issue under the section we were discussing previously, the definition of official misconduct in Local Government Code, Section 87011. And my question is, your argument seems to be premised on the thought that section requires a intentional mental state.
Yes.
And when you read the section, it says official misconduct means intentional unlawful behavior. And so my question is there a distinction between intentional behavior in this section and knowingly and intentionally performing an act under the penal code? In other words, your behavior can be intentional in situations where it's not with a knowing or intentional intent under the penal code. And so my question is, do those translate? Are those congruent? Or are we talking about two different things here?
Well, I think the Supreme Court has said you have to have evil intent in that DeAnda case, and also in the Supreme Court opinion. Well, actually, the DeAnda case was not a Supreme Court case, but Meyer is. And the part I quoted for you a few minutes ago is straight out of Meyer, which is, by the way, 360 Southwest 2nd at 520. You go on further in that statute and read, it says the term includes an intentional or corrupt failure, refusal, or neglect of an officer to perform a duty. So we're talking about corrupt, intentional, unlawful behavior here. That's what this statute deals with. And my point is, there's got to at least be a fact issue on that based upon the affidavit that was filed. His guilty plea was, in fact, in keeping with the charging document that he was charged with, but it did not include evil intent on his part to be convicted. And so, yes, he pled guilty. I know that the other side feels like we're collaterally attacking that judgment, but as I pointed out in my reply brief, this is not a collateral attack on a judgment. We don't really embrace the judgment, but we accept it and live with it. But the judgment did not include a finding of official misconduct, which is required under the statute under which he was removed. Now, just very briefly to talk about the judicial estoppel, or collateral estoppel, rather, point. It is an attempt, as the cases say, to avoid the binding force of a judgment in a proceeding not instituted for the purpose of correcting or modifying it or vacating it. We are not attempting to avoid the binding force of the judgment. He's paid his fine. He's served his probated sentence. That's not what this case is about. It's on a different issue. The different issue is whether he could be removed from office under a particular statute. And our argument is that he couldn't be because the conviction that he had did not include those elements. Now, I'm reserving some time. Those are the points that I wanted to make to the court. If there are other questions the court has, I'm happy to address them, or I'll save my time for later.
I have one, even though it's really not something briefed. I just was curious. This is a civil case, and then you said then we had the summary judgment motion. It was brought by an individual, though. Does that individual have standing to seek the removal?
Yeah, when you study the statutes, and I don't have it line and verse for you, Judge, but it is an appropriate way,
a taxpayer,
can bring such an action, but it is to be prosecuted by the county attorney.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Staten.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thank you for having me this morning. I'm going to start off with the Section 87031. I think that the key to 87031 implies that there is, and it's called immediate or automatic removal for a reason. Upon the conviction of either a felony or a misdemeanor. In this case, there's no doubt we have a conviction for a misdemeanor. The only question at issue is this misdemeanor, does it constitute official misconduct? That's the crux of the whole issue. Assuming it is, the automatic removal provisions apply, and this individual should be removed from office based upon that. Now, official misconduct, when you look at it, and you look and you break it down, it's intentional unlawful behavior. And if you look at this case, do we have intentional unlawful behavior? The plea says yes. I've quoted the sections of the plea. I think I attached them for the court. Specifically state that I am guilty of every act alleged in the indictment. The indictment alleged three different things. One, and I'm going to paraphrase here not to bore the court, use of county property, and in this case, misuse of county property, misuse of county personnel and facilities. In this case, appellant pled guilty to doing all three of those and admitted to doing all three, not just one, like he seems to indicate in his brief. They're all three, they're all in the indictment, and he said he pled guilty as alleged in the indictment. So where I'm going with this is, do we have intentional unlawful behavior? I don't think there's any doubt about that. The second question is that related to somebody's official duties? And again, this is another definition of what is official misconduct. In this particular case, this individual would not have access to personnel, facilities, or the materials without their position as a county commissioner in the county. Three, is he an officer? Yes, he's a commissioner. I don't think anybody gripes about that. And is he entrusted with the execution of law? Of course, we trust our commissioners who are elected officials to be the guardians over property which is entrusted to them. No different than me in my office, I'm entrusted as the guardian over my fee account, which has been heavily litigated amongst the courts as to prosecutors' fee accounts and other things. I've been entrusted to do that. No different than this individual is entrusted to maintain taxpayer property, materials, as well as personnel. So that's where we are here. So the question, I really don't think it's at issue as to whether or not there's official misconduct. Simply by virtue of not saying this is official misconduct, I don't know that that gets you out of it. And of course, I've made that clear in my brief. A couple of things that I'm going to try to address here for the court this morning. Collateral estoppel, when you read the cases on it, talks specifically about relitigation of facts. It doesn't talk about relitigation of one overall issue. It talks about relitigation of facts. And the idea behind it is that you don't get to come in and take two bites at the apple. In this particular case, the appellant was sitting there on the day of trial with 100 people sitting in the courtroom ready to go to criminal trial. It was on the day of trial. You guys have the court's docket sheet, I'm confident. It's on the day of trial. We're ready to go. He had the ability to litigate all of the facts that are in that we're talking about today, to litigate every one of those at the time. Instead, he chose to waive his right to a jury, plead guilty, admit that he did the acts as alleged by the felony prosecutor at that time. He's litigated those. He should not be given the ability to come back at a later date and relitigate this stuff. He shouldn't
be able. You just stated a moment ago that's not really what he's doing. It's not the question about whether he was guilty or not. The question is that misdemeanor an offense of official misconduct, or is it just abusive, whatever it was, the title that he pled to? So that's not really what the issue is here today. You stated it just a moment ago, what it really is.
Well, I think that, and I would agree with that to some extent, the issue of official misconduct is the ultimate question that the court's going to be faced with. The problem we have is it going back and giving them a second bite to relitigate facts that have already been litigated. That's, we believe there's a problem, and that's what they want to do. They want to try to go back and relitigate all these facts as it applies to whether or not it's official misconduct. I don't think they should be allowed to do that. I don't
say
think
in
they
your
should.
Brief you ask us not to consider Mr. Ross's affidavit because of objections that you had. Did you make those objections at the trial court level?
I did.
Did the court rule on them?
Court chose not to and chose to enter the summary judgment based upon that particular immediate removal section.
Now you're asking us to disregard something that the trial court considered. We can't do that. You understand that, don't you?
I do. Now, as far as the next point, there's quite a few cases that are on this particular issue of good faith, and I've cited them for the court. Good faith in your belief of doing thing has been held by several other appellate courts, not by the court of Supreme Court, but other appellate courts. Essentially states that the fact that you had some kind of good faith or belief that you weren't committing a criminal act doesn't get you out from under the fact that you were convicted of it at a later date. So I don't think that appellants should be able to come in here again and say, hey, I did it, I pled guilty to intentionally doing it, however, now I had good faith in doing it, and I should be given a pass. And those cases are on there. I think those cases are well-reasoned. And I think that in this particular case, coming in at a later date and saying, well, I didn't really mean to do it, or I didn't really do this, or I didn't really do that, I think is contradictory to the plea and is contradictory to the findings of the court at that time. Now, whether or not the trial court's failure to enter an order at that time really means anything. Our contention is it doesn't. I think the statute backs that up. The statute simply says, upon conviction for a felony or a misdemeanor involving official misconduct, the individual is immediately removed from office. There are several lower court cases out there that indicate that simply not entering an order at the time doesn't change the facts. And I think that follows the statute. When we talk about a fact issue, and I'm going to pardon me, my allergies are killing me this morning. I apologize for that. When we talk about a fact issue, I think that the statute itself contemplates potential summary judgment when it talks about immediate removal. It doesn't contemplate a trial. It contemplates that upon conviction, somebody is removed. It doesn't contemplate that they're removed if you come back and you ask for a jury trial or anything else. And that's why this section is so important, because it deals with being automatically removed. It doesn't contemplate having a trial at a later date. That's a different section. That's not what we're talking about today. This is just one section about automatic removal. So to come in and ask and want the court to give somebody the ability to have a trial at a later date, whenever this section applies, I just don't think it makes sense.
But it does also say that the judge who rendered the original judgment shall enter. In other words, it's a mandatory, non-discretionary duty. And for whatever reason, the trial court that entered the judgment of conviction failed to enter that as well.
And there have been several cases, and I'll agree, that is the facts of this case. There have been several cases where that's happened. And I think four or five that I cited in my brief. Where that's happened, they've said that in and of itself doesn't mean that the conviction didn't happen. It doesn't mean that the person isn't guilty of official misconduct. That they seem to reason it more of a formality rather than something that just says, if you don't do this, you automatically get a pass. And that's the way those cases
are. But don't you agree there has to be an effective removal date?
Well, and I think that upon conviction, that's what the cases have said.
Well, then what happens if there's not an order of removal and the person continues to sit and do their duties and issue orders? Are their actions void? I mean, what?
Well, that's why, and I'll give the court a little picture here. The way this case comes to bear is that it's required that a citizen come in and bring it to me, basically. And then I'm entrusted with going out and getting approval. I have to get approval from the court, similar to quo warranto. I have to get approval from the court before I can actually go and do anything on it and take any action on it. And that's the way that it goes. So in this particular case, it would be incumbent upon me if somebody I had believed and a citizen had brought this to me and said that an individual is now convicted and I believe it's official misconduct, it would come on me to bring this as an action and bring it as a summary judgment and do exactly what I'm doing now and contend that their removal date was the date of conviction. And I think that's where the cases go. If you read those cases, there have been very similar instances to what we've had here. And I think I cited a one where an individual was charged with a couple of misdemeanor cases. And even the court in that case said that he shall not be removed from office. The court was very specific. The trial court was saying that the individual shall not be removed from office. The Court of Appeals came back and said, No, the conviction at that point is what is the date. That's the critical time, is when is the conviction. And I think the hope is that somebody that's in my position wouldn't let somebody continue to be in office post-conviction for something that would appear to be official misconduct. Now, in this particular case, there's some argument in appellant's brief about, you know, that if you got convicted of a possession of marijuana or a DWI or some other type of offense, I don't think those apply at all, because I'm assuming that somebody's not DWI in a county vehicle. I could see how that might apply. But a simple DWI or possession of marijuana or something outside somebody's office wouldn't apply to a case like this. So I really don't think there's any problem with that there. Now, and I feel like I've briefed this adequately, but when we talk about whether or not something's official misconduct, I think the court can see my argument clearly is that that's a question of law for the judge to determine, not one for the jury, and in any particular case. And the reason for that is that if you read the statute for removal, it talks about the questions that would go to the trial court in the case of removal. And what it says specifically in there is that the questions that would go to the trial court would be whether or not the allegations are true. That's what the statute requires. In fact, the statute goes on to say that there are no special issues to be submitted to the jury even. What I glean from that is that the real question for the jury is whether or not certain things are true in a particular case, not whether certain things are official misconduct, whether things are wrong, morally right. There's been several cases where they said it was improper to go to a jury and ask them, should somebody be removed? The only thing that gets submitted is whether or not these things are true. That leads me to believe that other questions, for example, whether or not an offense constitutes official misconduct, is up to the court. And I think that's really, if you read the statute, that's where we are. So in this particular case, even if you effort that, even if you go out to that point and say, okay, you're going to have a jury like appellant wants, all of the facts in the case have already been determined to be true by virtue of the appellant's plea. They've already been litigated. And that's the real issue here. There aren't any questions of fact left. Those have been all established at this point. Whether or not the appellant in this case did unlawfully appropriate county property, unlawfully appropriate county personnel, unlawfully appropriate county facilities has already been established. There aren't any more fact issues here, despite what appellant wants to bring out, and it's despite the affidavit, despite all this other stuff. It's already been established by his plea. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Staten. Mr. Fielding, rebuttal.
Just a few points. Official misconduct is not a question of law. Under the statute, you know, I think I made a point that they did it under 887.031, which is subsection B, I think it is, maybe C. Under the previous subsection, you have a jury trial as a matter of right, statutory right there, and official misconduct is one of the questions. He doesn't cite a single case for the proposition that whether it's official misconduct or not is a matter of law, because that's not what the law is. He did talk to you about there being two cases in his brief where the convicted party tried to raise the question of good faith and was held not to be a defense. The first of those cases is Lewis versus State. Corpus Christi opinion in 1989, the Justice of the Peace gave 6 arrest warrants without complaints, assessed 5 withdrawal fees, made false entries or warrants, and he said he didn't do it knowingly or deliberately. And the court said it's not a defense because he was removed for incompetency and official misconduct. And under incompetency, as the DeAnda case points out, gross negligence is enough. And so the second case is the Teal case out of San Antonio. That official was also removed for incompetency and official misconduct, and guess what? He got a jury trial. So, of course, coming in later and saying, well, okay, I got a jury trial, but I didn't really mean it, Of course, that's not going to be a defense for him. Now, with respect to his opening point, which is will be my closing point, here's what the indictment says. He was charged with building a playhouse for his grandchildren on public property. I don't even know if that is a violation of the law, but he did it. It was public property. Secondly, utilizing public employees. Okay, some of the guys would come in at the end of the day. They'd been out doing their work all day, and they would help him chalk a line, or they'd hold the board while he nailed it. Right at the end of the day when they didn't have anything else to do.
The third, but counsel, these facts have already been admitted to.
I understand that.
Correct. So really the question is whether or not the plea of true or guilty to the offense of abuse of official capacity constitutes official misconduct.
And it only constitutes official misconduct if he had evil intent. And what the affidavit shows is that he didn't have evil intent with regard
see,
to any of these.
That's where items. My question is, because the statute says official misconduct means intentional, unlawful behavior. And it's clear that he admitted to unlawful behavior.
Right.
So the only issue then is whether intentional behavior requires an intentional mental state.
The Texas Supreme Court says official misconduct must be willful, or in other words, with evil intent. That's straight out of their opinion in the Meyer case, or without reasonable grounds to believe the act lawful. Now, I don't think he's guilty of any of that. That's
or without reasonable grounds to believe that the act is unlawful, but yet he stipulated that he committed an act that was unlawful.
That's true. He did. He pled guilty because.
And he signed a stipulation.
And he knew that he had built that playhouse, or that treehouse is what he calls it, in the county barn. He knew that some of the guys may have come over and helped him a little bit. Does that show evil intent? I don't think so. I don't believe that they have proven. I don't think that the guilty plea establishes evil intent on his part. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fielding. Mr. Stanton, we appreciate all your arguments and your briefing on this matter. It's all very helpful to the court. We appreciate you being here as well today. Your case is now submitted and you all are excused. Thank you. We will proceed on to the next.